My name is Dan Spencer, and today I'm returning to some of the things I talked about last week, focusing on Central America. The topic today is the war in El Salvador, its roots, and why it continues. A lot of the reason I'm doing this session, last week we focused on the church in Central America and did a whole historical look at the church and how the church is made up today. Did a session on the church in El Salvador. But people also wanted to know more about what is currently happening in El Salvador. So what I would like to do is to try and give us a framework for understanding why El Salvador is now in its seventh year of civil war and why the outlook for a quick end to that civil war is particularly bleak at this time. I want to give us a framework for trying to understand that, so I'd like to start with just a historical sketch so that you understand that what is happening in El Salvador is the current culmination of a very long process. It's not something that has sprung up overnight. And then to have some time then to look at some of the major influences in El Salvador today. I've sketched a map here of Central America just to get you oriented. El Salvador is somewhere towards the center of it. It's the only Central American country that doesn't have an Atlantic coast to it. All the other countries have both Atlantic coast and a Pacific coast. El Salvador is the smallest of the Central American republics. It's about the size of Massachusetts, a little smaller. Has a population of somewhere between 5 and 6 million, and is by far the most highly densely populated of the Central American countries. Another thing about El Salvador's population is over one-fifth of it, over 1 million of its people are displaced, either outside of the country as refugees or inside the country as internally displaced people. And when Mary does her session on sanctuary, we'll hear a little bit more about the U.S. connections with the displaced in El Salvador. But I think today we can get some framework for understanding why so many people are displaced in El Salvador and why the war continues to go on there. The first thing I've written up here, and I don't know if everyone can see it, but it's the whole situation of land. That, I think, is the ultimate root of the conflict in El Salvador. The land distribution is so skewed that the vast majority of the people do not have access to the land. Now, in the United States, our land distribution is also skewed, but we are not predominantly a rural-based country anymore. Most of us don't derive our livelihood from farming. In a country like El Salvador, where the vast majority of the people are dependent on the land for their survival, having such a skewed distribution of the land is devastating to the majority of the people. I've just written up some of the statistics here. 57% of the land is owned by 2.5% of the people. So almost 60% of the land is owned by 2.5% of the people, and it's by far and away the best land. Then there are some middle lands where 21% is owned by a little over 5% of the people, 18% is owned by another 7.5%, the sort of intermediate lands. But the important statistic, almost 85% of the people own less than 4% of the total country. And these are the people who are by and large dependent on the land for their survival. This, I think, is the basic dynamic that explains everything that has happened, or not everything, but much of what has happened in El Salvador in the last century. And I'd like to go through a quick sketch to see how this developed. We're going to go back into the 1800s. In 1856, Europe began to demand coffee. There was an increase in the demand for coffee, and the countries in Latin America, particularly in Central America, responded through a number of legal and illegal means to get coffee planted in their countries. El Salvador, the rural people in El Salvador inherited a system from the Native Americans living there, which held the land communally. There was essentially no such thing as private ownership. There were two types of land, but essentially there was either village lands or communal lands. They were held in common, and the people decided together how to plant the lands in order that everybody benefited. In 1856, the government of El Salvador passed a law that required campesinos, and campesino is the word in Spanish for people of the land, or we loosely translate it as peasant, but all campesinos were required to plant two-thirds of their land in coffee. So right away, two-thirds of the land mass that's in agriculture in El Salvador is now being devoted to coffee, and this begins to develop an economy in El Salvador that is oriented around the export of coffee. In 1880, 1881, there were two phases of what is known as the liberal land reform. not because it's necessarily liberal in the way we think of it, but because the governments that are in power there were the liberals instead of the conservatives. And the liberals wanted to modernize the economy. In order to modernize the economy, they had to have control over the land. What the liberal land reform did was outlaw all communal lands. It now became illegal to have communal lands or municipal lands, and then these lands in turn were taken through a number of different means from the people and given to private individuals. This is where you have the origins of what has been called in El Salvador the 14 families. That is a very small group of people, the economic elite, that own the vast majority of the land and the wealth. And it's very interesting, if you go to El Salvador and look at the names of these people, because you have names like Wright, Guzman, Davison, they're oftentimes French, German, English surnames. What was happening at this time was that people from Europe were coming to Central America and establishing vast, essentially mini kingdoms in these countries. And so the very wealthy and powerful in these countries oftentimes do not have Spanish surnames, but have surnames from other parts of Europe. They came during this time and they got the land during this land reform period.
Excuse me, was that because they wanted to guarantee the continued export of coffee?
They wanted to, yeah, their goal was to modernize the economy, to bring El Salvador into the modern world. They wanted to institutionalize an economy built around export crops. The only way they could do that was by controlling the land, because up to this point, people had been using the land to build or to grow crops for their own consumption, basic grains, so forth. And so by outlawing communally held lands and putting in the individual, they accomplished two things. They expelled many of the people from the land, and so they got control of the land that way. And then they incorporated the land into an economy that was conducive to private ownership, capitalist kind of export economy. What happened then, of course, is the people who had formerly lived on the land and worked on the land now became the land workers, the laborers for the large owners, but they no longer had direct access to the land. They worked the land for others. Yes.
I don't understand how outsiders were able to come in like that. Were they there under the pretense of offering economic development through capital, or?
But the question is, how did the outsiders get involved in this? There were a number of different things that were going on, but partly the government was short on capital and needed to get capital from outside the country in order to be able to do the kinds of things that it did. Wanted to do with the economy, and so it invited people in from outside who had some capital. They in turn got land in exchange, and they began to develop a coffee industry. And then later, such things such as cotton and sugar cane become developed as well. What happens between the 1880s and 1920s is a series of, I mean, the people did not take this lightly. This was a drastic change for them. And there was a period of civil unrest in there, and constantly these protests being put down by the National Guard, different police forces within El Salvador. But this really culminated in the 1920s, when the world economy began to decline, and this drastically affected countries that had single export crop economies, because when Europe and the United States are no longer buying coffee because we're in depression, these countries very much suffer. So there's economic decline and increased hunger, and that in turn brings with it much civil unrest. And this, there was a lot of protest movement during this time, and there was a man named Farabundo Martí, who emerged this time as a leader among the campesinos and the people, the poor essentially, and tried to organize them. In the 1920s, you remember this has appeared right after the Russian Revolution, and it sort of that in turn set off a spark among working class people and poor people around the country. Farabundo Martí founded the Communist Party of El Salvador during this time and began to organize the campesinos and the working class to protest for better rights and access to basically to food, but access to ways of living. In 1931, there was a coup that overthrew the president at that point. And just a footnote, that was the last elected civilian president in El Salvador until 2 years ago. From 1931 all the way until 1984, we have no more elected civilian presidents, only military dictatorship and militarily elected presidents. But 1931, he is overthrown. A few months later, with General Maximiliano Hernandez Martinez, and don't worry about the name, but he was, what happened was he in that kind of conjunction with the oligarchy, decided they needed to take action against the growing protest movement in El Salvador. And this is probably the watershed date, much the way the Civil War in our country is oftentimes seen as a watershed date for many things. 1932, General Maximiliano Hernandez comes into power and arrests Farabundo Martí, execute him, and in the space of 4 days, somewhere between 4 days and 2 weeks, executes or kills 30,000 peasants and Indians in El Salvador. This was somewhere between 2 and 4% of the national population. So one in every 25 people was being killed at this point in a bloodshed that just eliminated the protest movement and brought a whole reign of terror to El Salvador. The thing is, for me, that oftentimes sounds like way back then, but I've talked to many people in El Salvador who are still alive who remember that. So it's much the way I think people remember the stock market crash. It makes an incredible impression, but almost everybody in El Salvador knew people or had family members who were killed in this. What this did was bring a very tight alliance in the power between the military and the oligarchy. And the two working together control El Salvador for the next 4 or 5 decades. Always looking how to improve the economy, which improved the well-being of the oligarchy, and then the military serving to keep down any kind of civil unrest or protest that might develop. In the 1960s, I talked about this last time in talking with the church, but the United Nations declared the 1960s as the decade of development, and there was a great emphasis on development and how to help underdeveloped countries develop, the eventual goal of raising them up to the level of the developed countries. The United States was very involved in this, but the United States built much of its program in reaction to an event that took place in 1959, which was the overthrow of Batista in Cuba and the coming to power of Fidel Castro. So much of the United States policy since then in Latin America has been built around preventing any more Cubas. And if you follow the argument in El Salvador and Nicaragua, you'll hear oftentimes what we must prevent is Nicaragua becoming another Cuba. This becomes the cornerstone of U.S. policy, and that's important for El Salvador because the United States worked very hard to develop the economies in Central America during this time, but it did it in a two-pronged approach. It did it by giving economic aid that would develop the economies primarily around increased industrialization, but always around an export economy, and coupled that with military aid so that the militaries would be powerful and could put down any internal dissent. There was a lot of fear of communism creeping in at this point. And so in the 1960s in El Salvador, we see much economic and military growth going hand in hand. Towards the end of the 60s and the early part of the 70s, partly as a result of what's happening within the Catholic Church and an emphasis on working with the poor now, coming out of Vatican II and also some of the conferences in Latin America, the church for the first time makes what it calls a preferential option for the poor, saying that it's important what happens in the next life, but it's also important what happens in this life. And so the priests and the nuns begin to work with the poor. And the result of this is by the early 70s, there's a broad coalition movement building in El Salvador to elect people who will bring about economic reform and economic change. And so what you have is a movement that incorporates, on the one hand, parties like the Christian Democratic Party, the Social Democratic Party, and a broad popular base. And then you have the military, and the military has institutionalized itself through a party by now called the National Conciliation Party, the economic oligarchy, and the whole history of being in power. These are the two sides that are competing by 1972. This would probably be the second watershed event because two men ran for president and vice president under a coalition. And you'll hear their names oftentimes today. One was a man named Napoleon Duarte, and he is currently the president of El Salvador. He ran as the presidential candidate under this coalition. His vice presidential candidate is a man named Guillermo Ungo. Ungo is now the head of the opposition movement in El Salvador. So the two key players, one the president of the country today and one the head of a major opposition outside the country, were at that point running on the same ticket. They won the elections. By all accounts, they won the elections, but the military confiscated the ballot boxes, held them for 2 weeks, and then announced after they had recounted them that, lo and behold, the military had won. Duarte was put in prison, tortured, expelled from the country, mass repression against people who had supported him, and the military apparently thought that things could go on as usual now. They had once again managed to gain the power in El Salvador. Well, during the 70s, what happened instead was this broad mushrooming of this whole opposition movement, primarily through nonviolent street protest, mass demonstrations taking place out on the streets, where you had occasions where up to 500,000 people would take to the streets in San Salvador demanding change, demanding that there be land reform, demanding that there be minimum wage laws, demanding that there be maximum work time, all those kinds of things we take for granted they were fighting for just 10 years ago in El Salvador. The army responded by increased repression, and you went from having 30 or 40 political murders a month up to 200 or 300, until in 1979 there was a coup by some members of the military against the other members of the military, and this brought into place a new civilian military government. And that has kind of launched the most recent episode in El Salvador of there being an attempt between the military and the civilians to rule El Salvador. The 1980s is when El Salvador first begins to appear in our newspapers, and we really begin to hear about what's happening there. Many of you may be familiar with Archbishop Romero, who was an archbishop who's actively sided with the poor, and because of that was assassinated in 1980 by members of the government, or the death squads. You may remember the four American churchwomen who were raped and murdered in El Salvador in the same year in 1980 for the same thing, of working with the poor. And it now has become defined as subversive to work with the poor in any kind of way in El Salvador. And so the situation is polarizing, and this 1979-1980 period becomes critical for understanding the war, because there had been in the 70s a very, very small armed guerrilla movement in El Salvador. It probably never numbered more than 100 people at any one time, 100, 150 people who had taken up arms, had gone into the mountains, and were trying to build a guerrilla war against the government. The people, by and large, did not respond to that. What they did respond to was this large, broad-based, nonviolent opposition movement that was building with the support of the church, the labor unions, some of the other parties. And as I mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people for the first time became involved in this. Well, the period 1980 to 82 saw such incredible repression against this opposition movement, where by the time 1982 was over, you had somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 people who had been murdered for taking place in this opposition movement, that the government essentially accomplished what it wanted to do. It dismantled the opposition movement. People became terrified of having anything to do with protesting for social change. But what the government may not have counted on was it drove many of those people out of the city and off the streets and into the mountains to join up with the armed guerrilla movement. And so in these few years here, we see a mushrooming from the armed guerrillas going from anywhere from 100 to 200 guerrillas up to anywhere from 10 to 15,000 guerrillas fighting against us, the government in El Salvador. And so that from 1980 on is about the period when the war becomes a civil war rather than a protest movement that's being repressed by the government. That is essentially the background that gets us up to here. There are a lot of things that have happened during the 80s, and we can talk about them if you have questions about them, such as the election of President Duarte, some of those things. But this is the scheme or the sketch of what is happening. In 1980, there were, at that point, five different guerrilla groups, each one very small, and they joined together to fight to form a coalition that has become known as the FMLN, which they took the name of Farabundo Martí, who had been the labor organizer in the 20s. And it's the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front. Much the way, if you're familiar, in Nicaragua, they took the name of Sandino and became known as the Sandinistas, or the National Liberation, Sandinista National Liberation Front. Well, they're similar in El Salvador. They form a coalition group, take his name, and they are now fighting and have been fighting for the last 6 to 7 years against the government. At the other time, there was a group of opposition political figures who did not take up armed struggle but were forced to flee the country because they were being assassinated, And they are known as the FDR, which is the Democratic Revolutionary Front. They are political, non-armed, but they are in coalition. These two groups work together. The FDR tends to be in exile outside the country, pushing for change outside of El Salvador. The FMLN is the armed group that is inside El Salvador, fighting to overthrow the government. Any questions? I realize that's a very fast historical sketch, but I wanted just to give some idea of what the historical roots are. And I think tracing them into the land and the situation of skewed power relationships and land relationships that came out of that has led to all of these events here, with one group trying to maintain its concentration of power, the majority of the people trying to gain access to power so they can redistribute that. And that is the basic struggle there.
At any time during this historic period that you've been talking about, was the influence internal or was the influence external? In other words, did the United States or France or Germany or any other nation have a great deal of influence down there?
The United States has always considered Central America its own backyard. So it has always been very influential in that area. And for example, just south of El Salvador, during this period of the 20s, Nicaragua was occupied by U.S. Marines for 21 years. So the U.S. is very involved in this, and there is speculation how much the U.S. had to do with the coup that overthrew the last elected government here and brought the military into power as a means of controlling the opposition. The United States, you may remember at this time, was reacting very strongly against the Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union, and therefore was in a period not unsimilar to our own, reacting strongly against anything that might be communist or might they might label as communist. So there was a lot of influence, not direct military intervention, but a lot of influence. One of the ways that I had that, something that kind of illustrates that, the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador is referred to by many people there as La Casa Blanca of El Salvador, the White House of El Salvador. And so very little seems to get done without some collusion. That went in and out during the 50s. During that period up to this point. Now the opposition movement is, and that is where a lot of the controversy comes in as far as U.S. policy. The United States claims that it is Soviet-inspired and Soviet and Cuban run, and that the guerrillas who are there are simply proxies for the Soviet Union and the Cubans. And the question of how much influence they have is certainly open to debate. I believe, and I think what I've tried to sketch here is to show that there are very many internal reasons for what has taken place in El Salvador for the building of that kind of opposition movement. And so that there are certainly internal reasons for that taking place. Now, they may or may not be influenced today by that, but certainly I think their history comes out of this kind of history.
Has the United States Corporation had the same effect in El Salvador as in Guatemala, United Fruit?
You make reference to Guatemala and affected U.S. corporations. Guatemala is probably the most notorious one because United Fruit Company almost single-handedly, with the help of the CIA, overthrew a government there. Don't see that quite as much in El Salvador. There's certainly some influence of the economic factors there. But one thing, I think that the factors that are determining our policy towards El Salvador are much more ideological. And part of that, I would say that is we have already spent 5 or 6 times as much in military aid there as we have in original investment in the area. We don't have that large of economic investment, but we've put in a lot of military. Paul?
I was there just last summer, and it was interesting to me that that all the flowers and everything was taken away from the gardens outside of the embassy, and there were huge cement walls being built all around the embassy, and we as American citizens were required to check in all of our cameras and tape recorders. We were not allowed to tape anything that any embassy person said, and we weren't treated this way anyplace else in other, Nicaragua, Mexico, wherever.
I think there are 3 places in the world that have the maximum, highest level of security risk for embassy employees, one being Beirut and the other being San Salvador, and I forget the third, but it is, the embassy there has become like a walled fortress, and there's a great deal of tension or into the capital there because of this.
We weren't even allowed to take pictures of it from half a block away.
Mary?
Just to follow up on that, when I was at the Salvadoran Embassy in last November, we had to go through the same procedure, but we had heard that the night before, one of the high officials had said, oh yeah, we're getting a bunch of funky brainwashed Lutherans. We had not talked to us tomorrow, so when I got to ask a question, I said, I know you think we're a bunch of funky brainwashed Lutherans, but I just got this really weird look on his face.
Part of what Mary's making reference to.
Did you get funky answers in return?
We got Oreo cookies.
The largest cookies in the world.
Well, part of what Mary is referring to, and I talked about last week, but I looked at the church in El Salvador, is that the Lutheran church there has become very active in working with the poor. Primarily because of the vast numbers of displaced people that are flooding into the capital now. And as a result, has been labeled subversive by the government, and they have one of their pastors has been killed, over 50 of their members have been forced to flee the country. A lot of repression against the Lutheran Church, but there also have been a number of programs to connect up United States Lutherans with Salvadoran Lutherans and to build strong channels between them. And so there have been large numbers of Lutheran delegations going to El Salvador to talk to the church. And the embassy knows that by and large they are not favorable to what the government in El Salvador is doing to the Lutheran Church there. And so there has been this interesting dynamic. The reputation that the Lutheran Church is getting in the Salvadoran embassy is interesting in that way.
What about the Catholic Church?
Okay, the Catholic Church is also, well, let me just say, what I try to do here is the first half of this talk, the roots. And what I'd like to do in the second half and focus some of our questions on is why it continues. And what I'd like to do to start about that is just talk a little bit about the major role players that are involved in the struggle in El Salvador, because I think it's very difficult if you just read the newspapers to have an understanding of what's happening there. And somebody says one thing, somebody says another, and somebody says the death squads. Well, what are the death squads? Or the security forces? Well, what are the security forces? So if I can just go briefly through the major role players and how they interact, then I think we can talk about why the war is still continuing today. The first, and I think probably the most important role player is actually not Salvadoran, and that is the United States. The United States does consider Central America to be its backyard, and it considers itself to have a legitimate national security interest in El Salvador and throughout Central America. And it, as much as anything, determines the kind of policies that are developing within that country. So I would put them right at the top here. Secondly, and these are not necessarily in order, although for these first four, this four or five, this might be the order of importance and influence. The military. Military has been explicitly in power since 1932 until 1984, when officially Napoleon Duarte was elected civilian president. But in terms of who maintains the real power in El Salvador, it's very much a coalition between the United States and the military in their efforts to defeat the guerrilla movement. And then the El Salvadoran government with President Duarte is involved in that and is in an integral link in that. But there are more power, I'd say, lies in the military because of what's happening in the country. We can talk about that in a little bit. But thirdly would be the Salvadoran government. It's currently headed by the Christian Democratic Party, which was one of the parties that made up that broad opposition movement in 1972. A reform-minded party, comes mostly out of the Salvadoran middle class and the kind of emerging middle class there, rather than the old oligarchy. Still very important in El Salvador is the oligarchy. What I mentioned is the 14 families. It's probably closer to 40 or 50 families, but these are families, large, essentially fiefdoms, that that continue to have tremendous influence in the country. The ones that originally owned all of the land, then they owned the banking system, then they owned the export houses, so that they made sure that whatever economy was going through in El Salvador was filtered through their hands. And they have a tremendous influence still in the country. That I put together here, probably unfairly lumped together, but I think there is a link between them. What you hear of is the security forces and then the death squads. These are the primary tools of repression in El Salvador, i.e. they work on behalf of the oligarchy and the government to keep the people out of power, maintain them out of power, and they do it through a variety of of terror mechanisms. But the security forces are made up primarily of three forces, and you'll hear about these sometimes, the National Guard, the National Police, and the Treasury Police. Historically, each one of them had a separate role. Essentially, today, they all work in the same as a kind of a police force, but more than anything, what I would call a tool of repression that keeps protests at a certain acceptable level. When it begins to rise above that, they assassinate someone or carry an action out. Now, I lump the death squads with them because the death squads are privately funded, privately organized, kind of paramilitary forces. And there's a saying in El Salvador that the security forces operate by day, the death squads operate by night. They are essentially privately organized assassination squads that have ties to very, very conservative members of the oligarchy, and also have a number of ties to both the government security forces and the military. But these are, for example, the people that carried out the murder against Archbishop Romero. And many, many times the attempt when Medardo Gomez, the bishop of the Salvador Lutheran Church, when he was picked up a few years ago, he was picked up by civilian-dressed armed men. Those are the death squads. They are civilians who are hired, in a sense, to go out and assassinate people. Now, that would be, this would roughly be a coalition of forces on one side in El Salvador. The church, which traditionally formed in Latin America, you have what they call the triangle of power, which was the church, the military, and the oligarchy, or the wealthy elite. The church traditionally was a partner to these other two forces in maintaining order, maintaining power in Latin America. This has changed in the last 20 years, although there are tremendous struggles within the church. But increasingly, the church in El Salvador has chosen to side with the poor, the powerless there, and has been very influential and has suffered greatly for it. But I mentioned here that this was one that never makes the news, unfortunately, up here, so you wouldn't even know it exists in El Salvador. When we hear about El Salvador, it's painted between sort of the people that are supported by the Russians and the people that are supported by the United States with this vast mass of inactive people. Well, if you've ever been in Central America, you know what the new factor that's taking place in Central America is that the poor are organizing themselves. And this is taking place throughout Central America, and this is what is in turn shaking the institutions there that have been used to power. So there are vast, vast sectors of the poor, whether they're the rural poor or the urban poor, who have organized themselves into unions, into different federations, and are demanding their rights and demanding change. So the organized, and this is probably the sector that has suffered the most. The ones we don't hear about, because you don't hear about peasants when they're killed, but these are the people that just have been brutally repressed, and yet they still continue to organize. Finally, the other major important role player for what is happening is the coalition of the left, the opposition movement to the government and to the military. As I mentioned, the FMLN is the armed opposition. These are the guerrillas that are fighting within El Salvador. And the FDR is the coalition of political leaders who have sided with the FMLN. And they're all out of the country because many of their original leaders were assassinated when they were inside the country. As I mentioned, there are no neat kind of distinctions. The current president of the country was the one who won the presidential election in 1972. And the current president of the FDR, the head of the FDR, was his running mate. At that point, they were on the same platform. Today, they represent opposite viewpoints. And this whole civil war and turmoil has split families, parties, all sorts of institutions, people not knowing how to, particularly in that 1980 to 82 period of incredible repression, people not knowing how to respond to that. And Duarte chose to respond by working with the military. Ungo chose to respond by working to overthrow the military. That's, in a sense, the major role players, and it's how they interact that makes up a lot of what is happening. Now, I just listed a few reasons why I believe that the war continues in El Salvador. The first would be that this situation has never been addressed, that there has been no profound social change in El Salvador, and so what I believe are the ultimate roots of the crisis are still there. Tremendous social polarization between a tiny, wealthy few and the vast majority of very poor people. And the land, there has been officially a land reform system in El Salvador, but it's much more cosmetic than it is real. It didn't touch any of the coffee lands, which is where the wealth comes in El Salvador, and which is what keeps the oligarchy so powerful. So there has been no attempt to address the, or there has been little attempt to address the profound social change that is needed in El Salvador. The second important factor why the war continues is the massive U.S. military and economic aid that is going to El Salvador that essentially is propping up the government there. And to give you an idea of the increase in scale of this aid, in 1980, the last year of President Jimmy Carter's administration, he was proposing a bill to send $5 million worth of military and economic aid to El Salvador. And Archbishop Romero wrote him a letter saying, "Don't you understand, if you send that, that will be used against the people of El Salvador, will only cause more bloodshed. Please do not send the $5 million. Carter, for a variety of reasons, chose to send it anyway. But that was $5 million in 1980. The current fiscal bill to send aid to El Salvador is over $500 million. We're sending over $500 million now to this country, of which somewhere between a third and a two-third, it depends on how you define that aid, somewhere between a third and a two-third of that is military aid. Someone calculated we spent over $150,000 per guerrilla now in military aid to El Salvador. But the United States' policy is to defeat the insurgency in El Salvador to prevent communism from coming over, and secondarily be concerned about social development and human rights. But the primary interest is defeating what it sees as communism in El Salvador.
Could I have a question?
Sure.
I've read a book that's an old book in the 60s that has written Don Hoff, wrote it. He claimed the United States 2.5% or 2% owns some fantastic amount of wealth through the interlinked directorates of corporations. And you add up there, it looks like you say, or almost 10% owns 78%. So that sounds to be a little bit better than the United States. But then I take issue with your analysis of the economic aid. All this money you say that's going in there to help them, I would suspect is be given by the United States National Guard, United States weapons manufacturers. In other words, to send a gun down there, which is a mounted piece of steel out of the ground, you know, fender of a car or something, they make quite a few guns. That's not much. We've got junkyards full of cars. So we can rip off a few fenders here. All that money stays in this interlock corporation in the United States. I don't see where there's any money going or any wealth being transferred down there. So in other words, there seems to be a big front to cover up the enrichment of our national police to fight communism somewhere else when we know that nothing really
okay.
happening except they have guns down there and they're shooting each other, which they've always been doing.
Right. If I gave the impression I was saying that this was economic aid that was helping the people, I stand corrected. What I meant to say was saying that the aid that goes there is divided into two categories, military and economic. And oftentimes it's broken down to lethal and non-lethal. We get sort of, and then it gets to humanitarian and how you include weapon or
uniforms
and jeeps and boots and stuff is humanitarian aid. It's beyond me. But the point is, the United States claims that the Reagan administration claims that one-third of that $500 million is for military, and the other is for development or economic aid. The congressional studies have concluded it's the opposite. The two-thirds is for military, and one-third is could be called economic development. And it's difficult to decide. When the United States builds roads in El Salvador that go out into the countryside, yes, they do help the peasants bring their produce into town, but they also go out to the military base. Is that economic aid? Is that military aid? If you're building a military infrastructure that also benefits the economy, how do you decide what kind of aid that is? So much of that middle, the point is most of the aid is built towards counterinsurgency effort, towards defeating the guerrillas. And part of that is providing enough economic stimulation that you draw away the appeal from the guerrillas. So even the economic aid is also geared towards eliminating the appeal of the guerrillas to the poor through economic development. And we can talk some more about that in a minute. Anyway, that I would say is the second most important, or one of the most second important reason why the war continues. If the U.S. cut off its aid tomorrow, the government would collapse. We don't know what would happen in its place. But the current government could not maintain itself without a vast influx of U.S. military and economic aid. And the third one that I think is particularly tragic for El Salvador is that the longer the war continues, the more polarized the nation becomes. And so what has happened is that people such as, I've used the example many times of Duarte and Ungo, but people who at one point could sit down and talk with each other and work for change are now increasingly polarized because this war has gone on for 7 years. It has bitterly divided the nation, and both sides are pretty well set in their ways. The problem is also why I don't think the war is going to end soon is that both sides are building on a strategy of prolonged warfare. Both sides think that if they can continue the war for several years, for example, the FMLN thinks that if it can continue the war for several years, that eventually the United States public will get tired of supporting this government, and that such as happened in Vietnam, the government will fall and the FMLN will be able to enter in there. So they are building their strategy over a prolonged war strategy. The United States has revamped its strategy in these regions. It no longer is advocating direct military intervention, probably because it doesn't think that the U.S. public would support sending troops to Central America. We have a tendency when it's their boys who are dying, it doesn't make as much of an impact. When it's ours, it does. And remembering the lessons from Vietnam, their conclusion is that unless you have U.S. support for the military intervention, don't build a strategy around it. What they are building is what's been called low-intensity warfare, which is that you just keep a low-intensity, Salvadoran explained to me that low-intensity warfare means you kill low-intensity people. But it does not low-intensity from their perspective. But from our perspective, it doesn't make the news, it just keeps going on, and you eventually try and just drain the support from the guerrillas. I put up here on this little map of El Salvador, and remember, this is about 60 miles from here to here and about 110 miles from here to here. You could fit several El Salvadors in the state of Washington. This is the primary area where the guerrillas have had their strength, up in northern and eastern El Salvador with a few other pockets, although they've been active in all parts of the country. Part of what the strategy of the U.S. and the military together is in their counterinsurgency is what has been called, if you dry up the ocean, you get rid of the fish. What do I mean by that? Guerrilla warfare depends on the support of the civilians in the area. If the guerrillas fighting in these areas do not have support among the peasant people living there, they can't continue to fight that war. They depend on them for food, for logistics, for information. And the U.S. and the military know that if they can get rid of the civilians in this area, they can get rid of they can get at the guerrillas. This is one of the real differences, by the way, between El Salvador and Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, you have two or three times as many Contras, people fighting against the Nicaraguan government, but they've not been able to claim any part of Nicaraguan territory because, by and large, they don't have enough support of the people to maintain that. In El Salvador, you're talking about 6,000, 8,000 guerrillas that control up to a third of the country because they have the support of the people in that region. Well, the military and the U.S. think if they can drive the civilians out of that region, they can, then that's the ocean, dry it up, they can get at the guerrillas for the fish. And so their emphasis, their strategy has been towards bombing now. There's a widespread bombing going on in these areas through army ground sweeps where you actually bring the army in there, physically remove the areas, take them to the Red Cross, take them to the church as refugees. And Mary will probably talk more about this when she talks about sanctuary. Where are all these people coming from who are leaving the country? Well, many of them are coming from these areas because the war has driven them out of their homes. But the point is not whether that's a good or bad policy. The point is both sides are orienting their strategy towards a long, drawn-out war. And the effort of the people who are working for peace is to try to get the sides together to find ways. One, the first step they're talking about is not even a ceasefire ending the war. The first step they're talking about is humanizing the war because the burden of the war has fallen on the civilians. It hasn't fallen on the armies. It's fallen on the civilians who are caught in these war zones. And they're trying to humanize the war. When we say humanize the war, for example, eliminate bombings of civilians. Eliminate random landmines that are placed out in areas where civilians walk by. Eliminate the kinds of warfare that end up having civilian victims more than they do soldiers. If they can get some dialogue on that, then they're working to find ways that they can actually begin to lower the intensity of the war. But it's it's hard to feel hopeful if you're a person who is hoping for peace and justice in El Salvador. It's hard to feel hopeful in the short run because the sides are so polarized. They're both pretty well entrenched. Neither one can defeat the other. And so they're both aiming towards a long, drawn-out strategy. And I think El Salvador, even though it won't make the news in this country, the war is going to continue there for many more years. Well, that's my analysis. Any other questions?
I'd like to ask a question. Let's say, hypothetically, assume that President Reagan would invite you to come in and serve as his advisor. What would you tell him to do?
Well, part of the problem is that President Reagan and I have two different worldviews, at least as far as Central America. You've gotten my interpretation today. Remember, this is an interpretation of the reality there. I really believe that this conflict has indigenous roots. I really believe that it comes from the poverty and from the widespread social disparity in the country. And I believe that until you begin to address those, you aren't going to make headway against what's causing the war. President Reagan believes that there is a conspiracy of communism to take over the Americas and eventually get at the soft underbelly of the United States up through Harlingen, Texas. And it sounds comical, but if you read his speeches, he is fixed in this perspective. First Nicaragua, then El Salvador, then Guatemala, finally Mexico. And the whole place will be communist, and they'll be overrunning us, and they'll be in Kansas City by next year.
It's the old domino theory.
It is the old domino theory, and it's been resurrected. And so he has a very difficult time seeing any indigenous roots here. Or if he sees indigenous roots, they are secondary to the fact that it's the communists who are doing all this. So the problem is there can be no quick solution in El Salvador. You know, people ask me, well, what would you do differently? Well, it's not like I can say, okay, let's stop this and start this and everything will be fine. It is so polarized, it is so divided now, it's going to be very difficult to work it out. But the first thing I would do is a shift in perspective. And I think at least Jimmy Carter had that going for him. I think he understood more that there were indigenous reasons on some of these conflicts. So I would begin to try to, one, I would work for serious negotiations between the FMLN and the government. There have been some peace talks sporadically, but I wouldn't qualify them as serious attempts to negotiate. So I would press for that. I would also really begin to address things such as the land. I mean, they carried out this land reform that existed much more on paper than in fact in many areas. And what that has done is raised expectations among the campesinos, but then they've seen those are dashed, and they have even less confidence in the government now. So I think, you know, the combination of getting the sides together to begin to do serious negotiations and beginning to address the social disparity in the country would be the way I would at least start working for
another thing that would have to be done. The human rights question would have to be addressed.
Certainly.
The elimination of the death squads.
Certainly, yeah. You'd have to have some serious looking at the security force of the death squads, how those, the repressive apparatus. You know, many people don't know, for example, in El Salvador, there is a law called Decree 50, which mandates that anybody arrested for any suspected political subversion can be held for 2 weeks incommunicado, meaning that for 2 weeks, no one can go in and see that person, including the International Red Cross. That is the time when all the torture and interrogation takes place. And usually what happens as well is that there's a forced signed confession where miraculously, everybody who's arrested comes out and says, sign a confession saying, yes, I did it. But that is a serious violation of human rights, and yet that is an official legal part of the government there. And those are the kinds of things that would have to be addressed as well. The judicial system is in shambles in El Salvador. Part of the reason they can't stop any of the killings is because they can't get a judge to try the cases, they can't get anyone to serve on the juries. People are afraid of being killed by the death squads.
The thing that impressed us when we would go through airports and so on is that we would meet a different class of people than we were meeting out there. And we finally figured out that the members of the oligarchy are essentially jet setters. And many of them know two or three languages, and they can converse intelligently and very convincingly with Americans that they meet.
They're fluent in English, yeah.
Oh, yes. They know excellent English.
If you ever come from the flight from Miami to El Salvador, it's astonishing. You get off in this very poor, underdeveloped country in this nice airport, and then all these beautifully dressed Salvadoran families come out carrying their boom boxes. I mean, there's these enormous stereo systems because they go up to Miami to shop. And you just are overwhelmed watching everything they bring back from Miami. And their kids are educated in the United States and Europe. They're very well, they're very sophisticated, they're very intelligent.
That's what I have seen in places where I've been. These are the young people who are coming to the graduate schools at Stanford, Yale, and Harvard.
Yeah.
And when our professors go down to those countries, maybe not so much now, but originally, they stayed in the homes of the
sure.
oligarchy, and then came back and gave this very distorted picture of what was happening.
Or when you see U.S. aid programs bring students up from these countries and study in our schools, it's not usually the campesinos that are being brought up to learn agricultural engineering. So it's, you know, there's a whole different perspective that's in place there.
Which then brings up the point that the book The Ugly American made a long time ago. Russia, on the other hand, takes these campesinos and takes them to Russia or wherever and it's a much smarter than we're doing.
Yeah, and you can argue whether what they get in Russia is good or not, but certainly they are perceived as helping these people. And that, you know, in terms of our stated goals of U.S. policy, is undermining U.S. relations in the area.
What does Reagan see for El Salvador after the war? You know, assuming that the guerrillas will all be put down. I mean, what does he see then? Does he see the United States coming in and completely taking over the military government, or?
Well, I hope this doesn't come out sounding too harsh on President Reagan. I think that his, you know, he's never even traveled in areas like that in a way that would have any impact on him and what the country is like. I think that President, you know, these countries are getting the underside of an international capitalist economic system that has benefited countries like ours tremendously in terms of material wealth, but has drained many of these countries. And I think that President Reagan sincerely believes that capitalism provides two cars in every garage and a nice lawn out in front. And that I think he sincerely believes that if those communists were just not there, and we put in a nice president like President Duarte, and the people just do as they're told, that things will be fine.
Just take care of itself.
Certainly, his speeches seem to indicate that's the kind of approach he's taking there. Now, I'm sure he has advisors who are much more sophisticated than that.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about his advisors? Just seems ridiculous to me. I'm an ignoramus coming in here saying I know nothing about El Salvador, inform me, and I'm just shocked at, you know, from your perspective anyway, why is he even doing this? What's the bigger view?
Well, part of it is, at one point I said I don't think that the economic interests are primary in El Salvador because we don't have that much. But in the larger view, they're very important because so much of our economy, economic relations with Latin America are built upon having access to their natural resources and us, you know, that interchange there. And I think the fear is not so much that one country like El Salvador might be cut off as an export market because it's just insignificant.
Yeah.
But the fear is if you have this trend developing where countries are beginning to address these kinds of things, because you have to remember that our having access to those export markets is dependent on there being a system of social inequality in place. The fact that we have access to cheap goods, cheap shirts, you know, if you look at the textile industry, you can't find shoes or clothes very often that are made in this country because they have to be made now where labor is cheap, and they can do that because this kind of system is in place. So I think long range, they're very frightened that there's going to be a hemisphere that is, one, hostile to the United States, secondly, is does not provide us an economic market that to keep our government or our economic system going. And, you know, in some sense, I agree with them. I mean, that's one point where I probably agree with them. I agree that, you know, ultimately Nicaragua and El Salvador, if they were allowed to carry out this kind of change, would cost the United States because we wouldn't have access to the easy kind of fruits of their labors that we have. Yeah, I forgot to mention, I mean, El Salvador, the annual per capita income is about $500. That's what the average person makes a year. Now, the average, that includes the wealthy there. You know, that means that the campesinos earn $120, $130 a year, $10 a month, 30 cents a day. You know, that's what happens when we eat Chiquita bananas. We don't see what has gone into that nice tasting banana. And yet, if we seriously look at addressing those problems, it means we're going to have to change our lifestyles in this country as well. And I think that's what gets so threatening.
Right.
It's very fitting. Mary?
There's a book in the bookstore, Add Justice to Your Shopping List, that Herald Press published. It's a really good little book about when you go shopping, keeping those things in mind and things that you can do as one person.
Mm-hmm. I think having my roots in the farm and so on, I've become aware that what has happened in El Salvador and in the other countries is happening here. And what is happening in our country is, and it started back in the 40s or 50s, was the corporatization of the American, especially the Middle West. The breadbasket of America is, and it's, even now, with the farmers going broke and so on, what is happening? I mean, what happens when these lands get turned over to the bank? The bank assigns them to ever bigger farmers.
See, it's, and again, this is my interpretation, so you can take it for what it's worth, but I think that we're seeing exactly the same kind of thing. Well, what happens when we invert the relationship of the land and the economy? And then the land, you know, it used to be that the economy existed so that there you had the access to the land and you could and you get the fruits of the land. Now the land exists to fuel the economy. And what happened in El Salvador in the 1880s when it no longer became important that people could feed themselves, what became important was that they could grow coffee to send to Europe, is a lot of what we're seeing happening in this country as well. That it's no longer as important that, family farms are there. What's important is that we have an economic system in place that maintains a corporate farming structure to feed an economy rather than feeding people. But I just want to address a few things because there are some excellent books in the bookstore and probably in the library that you might want to take a look at while you're here. One that I mentioned before is a book called Inevitable Revolutions, The United States in Central America. And it will give you a much more in-depth perspective to the kinds of things that I've been talking about what has happened in the last, especially in the last two decades, that has taken Central America from being this sort of our image of a peaceful paradise to one that we now associate with constant revolution and turmoil. Very, very good book. A similar one that takes, or two others that take a perspective like that, but deal particularly with the church, are Penny Lernoe's book, Cry of the People. Excellent, excellent book called The Struggle for Human Rights in Latin America, The Catholic Church in Conflict with U.S. Policy. Because I mentioned it, I drew the line here, the Catholic Church taking one of the side of the poor and trying to address this situation. The United States is a role player that has sided with the military in trying to address the insurgency and eliminate that. And this book really shows how that conflict has emerged and what the dynamics are. This one's similar, The Religious Roots of Rebellion, how you take people who for 450 years have been very passive, submissive Catholics and suddenly turn them into people in almost overnight working for social change. Philip Merriman has worked with the American Friends Service Committee and lived in Central America for many years. Very, very good book. If you want to get more of the kind of human side, Joan Didion has a short book that is just powerful. It's only 80 or 90 pages. And it is just her experiences of being in El Salvador. And it will give you, if you haven't been there, it will give you much more the feel of what it's just like to be in the country where the body dumps are, the death squads, the tension that engulfs the country. But she writes very well. It's very readable. And then In Search of Refuge will tie in closely with what Mary will be doing on Sanctuary. Yvonne Dilling went to Honduras to work with the Salvadoran refugees who were fleeing El Salvador. And she contrasts what she heard from the refugees about El Salvador versus what we learned through the media here. Finally, the last one is just an excellent book on, if you're interested specifically on the issue of sanctuary, about the churches opening themselves to Salvadoran refugees. This is the sanctuary, the Underground Railroad is good. And part of the whole problem is because the United States has such vested interest in protecting this, it refuses to recognize that this military oligarchy combination has caused refugees. And so some of you may be familiar with the sanctuary issue. The United States refuses to recognize that the people fleeing El Salvador are political refugees. Therefore, it's illegal to harbor them. Therefore, you have people who do that in the churches getting arrested and sentenced to prison for doing it. But it is a situation where the United States has such a vested interest in supporting the government that it's difficult for the U.S. to admit that the government is doing things that would cause people to flee a repressive state. You had a question, Carl.
Well, just what is the magnitude of the Russian involvement? You don't have one of the major role players, Russia.
Right.
If Reagan is saying, I'm doing this because I'm afraid of communism coming in, what is there some studies? Do we know how much aid you're getting from Russia? What is the Russian involvement?
A very good book that I would recommend for people to take a look at sometime is one by Charlie Clements called Witness to War. Charlie Clements is a Quaker, a U.S. doctor, who went to live in the war zones of El Salvador for a year, and he lived with the people who were in the war zones, and so he had a lot of interaction with the guerrillas, and he talks about how the guerrillas are armed, what that kind of thing. The vast majority of their arms seem to come from the black market, primarily from Miami, ironically enough. There is a tremendous international black market in arms dealing, and they've been able to purchase a lot of that through that. I don't want to be politically naive. I'm sure the Soviet Union is delighted that all this social turmoil is going on in the backyard of the United States. And if they have a chance to help foment it, I'm sure they'll probably try and do so. But I think that certently the magnitude of Russian involvement is nowhere near what the U.S. is. The guerrillas themselves, and you talk, the embassy says essentially that the Soviet Union is not so involved now because the guerrillas have what they need, they don't need it as much anymore. Their perspective is not so much that the Soviet Union is sending a lot of arms as the fact that these are the leaders of the guerrillas are proxies for the Soviet Union, so as soon as they do win, then the Soviet Union will have a new communist state in here.
So it's not like shiploads of equipment?
No, but I mean, the problem is, you know, and this is the whole controversy. I mean, where would these arms come from? You know, they have to come in through Honduras, they have to come in through Guatemala, which are friendly to the U.S. and tightly controlled. We have 3,000 soldiers in Honduras monitoring this. The only other place, you'll notice that Nicaragua and El Salvador do not share a border. They are separated by a body of water that's known as the Gulf of Fonseca. The United States has accused Nicaragua several times, and this was the original justification for supporting the Contras, accused Nicaragua of sending shiploads of material into El Salvador to support the revolution in El Salvador. And originally in 1980-81, this probably was the case. Immediately after the Sandinista triumph, there probably were arms going across there. But the problem is that does anybody know what was the group that disproved this theory? Very interesting. Who disproved the theory that there were arms going from Nicaragua to El Salvador? The CIA. The CIA did an intensive study on this with a man named David Michaels, whose only job was to try and document the flow of arms going from Nicaragua to El Salvador. And he came up and said, there aren't any. There aren't any going. And he got fired. And so they tried to find someone else who would find it. But the problem is, the United States maintains a radar monitoring station on an island in here, has heavy, heavy presence in this area, and can't document the fact that these arms are going through there. And that is a real embarrassment for it. It keeps making the charges, but it can't find any proof.